What if one of America's greatest literary minds never stopped writing, even after death? In 1917, a book emerged claiming to be dictated not by man, but by ghost. Its author, the restless spirit of Mark Twain. Its tool, the Ouija board. Tonight, I'm joined by the incomparable Varla Ventura, researcher of the strange and author of All Things Wonderfully Weird, as we crack open the chilling tale of Jap Herrin, a novel allegedly penned from the afterlife through the hands of a woman named Emily Grant Hutchings. Is it a spiritual hoax or spectral authorship? We summon the truth right here, right now on the Paranormal 360. And joining me on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline, the one and only Varla Ventura. Good evening, Varla. Thanks for being here.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
We just had a chance to talk with Bob Murch about the kind of impact and effect that Ouija had on mainstream media with movies, TV, music, everything. And it's really kind of interesting that it had an effect, but then all of these other, I guess, outlets also had an impact and an effect on Ouija board itself. Where do you stand? I know that you've written and you've got a great new article out. I don't know. We don't even call it an article. You have the new Shadow Zine magazine that's out, and that's it right. Is all about
issue number three.
Yeah, issue number three, Mark Twain's Ouija mystery. Where do you stand on the enigma that is the Ouija board? It seems like there's a pretty solid line of haters, lovers of this tool.
Yeah, I know the Ouija can be very polarizing, even just within the paranormal community. It can be kind of polarizing. Well, I love Ouija boards, so big surprise. I mean, I think the Ouija board gets a bad rap, and I think some of that is, of course, due to its representation in movies and in film, especially. 1980s and early 90s did a lot to scare people off of the, Ouija.
As a child of the 80s, do not blame me, because it was the 1970s, those hippie, weirdo, radical leftists that came out with the Exorcist movie. And that, like 8 seconds on screen, is what radically flipped.
Yes, no, absolutely. Absolutely. The Ouija board, then the Conjuring. And but I think it gets a bad rap. I really do. I think people have this assumption that there is something within the board itself that is somehow demonic and somehow like evil or something. And I just don't subscribe to that. I think that it's a tool like any other tool. It's a divinatory tool. And that is what it was traditionally used for. You know, various forms of divination through spirit boards prior to them being, you know, officially Ouija boards have been used for centuries, right? So if that were really true, if every time you were doing that, then, you know, all of these people would be like writhing around possessed and all the demons would be unleashed. I don't know. Maybe they were. Maybe that's the state of the world we're in. But I just think it's a tool like any other tool. I think it's a powerful tool. I think there's something about it in particular, because it has the alphabet and the yes, no, goodbye on it, that gives us this very haunting feeling, because other forms of divination, such as automatic writing, okay, a person goes into a trance and they start just, you know, channeling, scrying, or, you know, there's so many different kinds of divination. None of those actually spell out words. The Ouija board does. And I think that gives us chills down our spine, because we start to get those answers. You know, it's a little bit like an EVP recording when you hear the word yes or something. It's just more affirming. And I'm not sure we're always ready for that affirmation. So.
Well, I know Bob does not necessarily stand on the side of it's paranormal. Right. You know, we know the idiomotor effect, the micro movements that are going on. There's a big faction of people to believe, well, it is in fact the spirits using you, you're channeling like an automatic writer. You become the scribe, and it is through you that these spirits are affecting and impacting the equipment. But Varla, I've been on investigations where people whip out their dowsing rods and they swear by the dowsing rods and they get remarkable responses. And I watch large groups of people just stop. They freeze. They stop their investigation to watch these two copper rods either cross or swing apart. And I I have video footage where I zoom in on their hands and I could see their hands tipping and tilting they will swear by everything holy, they're not moving. So like some divination tools, those and the scrying pendulums, the ones where our hands are innately involved.
Yeah.
I always seem to, you know, I can notice the little effect of their movements and hands, but it's, I don't know if it's their consciousness not allowing them to see that they are affecting these things. Where do you stand on other divination tools like this? Do you believe that it really is something spiritually affecting us, or are we becoming part of the transfer of energy that the spirits are utilizing us to communicate?
So a little bit of both, actually, because first of all, something that's happened to me using the Ouija board is like there's a kinetic energy that happens. And so with kinetic energy, you know, your thoughts are basically projecting and you're subconsciously pushing this planchet around. And I've experimented with that by using the Ouija alone, which is something people think is really scary, but I don't know, it's kind of fun. But I've also had sort of more unexplained experiences, including my first like real Ouija experience that I had when I was, you know, like 7 years old. But, you know, I think with scrying, I mean, even with the use of any kind of divinatory tool, tarot, whatever it is, we're looking for answers. We're not doing it because we don't want to know something. And so we're looking for answers. And if you're in a seeker mode, you're going to find something. However, I do believe that it can be used as a divine conduit. I absolutely believe that any tool can be used as a divine conduit in the right frame of mind and in the right circumstances. But just like any kind of paranormal experience, you're going to just walk in and it's going to happen. It doesn't work like that. And so I think like with Ouija, you know, being able to kind of put yourself in the right frame of mind and be in a situation where you trust the people that you're with. And also just like, well, let's just see what happens. Not necessarily trying to determine something, but I still think that that's rare. I think a real trance mediumship is rare. And I think there's a lot of us that, you know, want to see things that may or may not be there. So right. I'm kind of a little bit in both camps. I think it exists. I think it really does happen. I think it is real, but I also think that there's a lot of stuff in the way. And sometimes people, you know, they want to believe, and I don't blame them. I mean, I do too sometimes, you know. But as far as like other divinatory tools, I mean, that's, you know, ask anyone who reads tarot and they'll tell you, oh, I can read your cards, but if I pull one for myself, I have no idea what that means because I don't want the message that it's there to receive. So it's a little bit of, it's not really a black and white issue for me. It's a, you know, blurry, smeary, messy issue.
What is not a blurry, messy issue is number 3 of Shadow Zine. And you can find more information by going to shadowzine.com. Mark Twain's Ouija Mystery, Varla Ventura is the author. It is all about the book that was channeled through a Ouija board called Tap Heron. We'll talk a little bit more about that case, the story, and might just surprise you to find out that this isn't just the only book that's ever been claimed to have been written from the other side. Let's talk a little bit more about Ouija. We'll talk a little bit more about Mark Twain, and we'll do that next right here on the Paranormal 360.
Oh, are you reading? Come in. Hello?
Greetings from the shadow, and welcome to Shadow Zine. My name is Jeff Belanger. I'm an author, podcaster, and explorer of the unexplained. For 30 years, I've been investigating the paranormal, UFOs, monsters, and things that bump in the night. Lately, you may have noticed how major TV networks and even social media networks have been pushing our favorite subject back into the shadows. I say good. That's why I launched Shadow Zine, a monthly underground publication that covers your favorite topics in depth by some of the leading writers and researchers out there. If you're looking for 30-second TikTok clips, go somewhere else. If you're ready for a deeper dive, put down your phone and pick up Shadow Zine. You can't find it in stores. This is old school print. Head to shadowzine.com and be part of the underground revolution. That's shadowzine.com, and I'll see you in the shadow.
Viva la Revolution. Mark Twain's Ouija Mystery. That is issue number 4 of Shadow Zine. And now that you've heard about the magazine itself and the amazing things that are covered, let's talk about this journey. Take me back, if you will, to 1917. This is what, like about 5-6 years after the death of Mark Twain, correct?
Yeah, I believe he died in 1910. So the publication was 1917, but this process to write this book started, I believe, in like 1916. It took her over a year, maybe even late 1915. So first of all, it's very important to understand the kind of the context of the times. Please. Which is that, so the spiritualist movement was still thriving. The spiritualist movement being the belief that not only we can talk to the dead, but that they have messages for us. So this is where the popularity of the spirit board and mediums, the famous Fox sisters, were kind of at the forefront of the spiritualist movement in the 1840s. So 1865, Civil War, lots of dead in the United States, a nation in mourning. Spiritualism has another uptick. It doesn't really go away, and it still exists today, of course. But by 1917, you know, we had World War I was kicking off. We hadn't joined it quite yet when Emily was starting this project. But there was a little bit more of a interest in the spiritual, you know, the paranormal parlor games, so to speak. And the other important thing to understand is that for women at the time, the spiritualist movement really gave them a lot of autonomy. You know, you didn't have too many, you know, late Victorian, going into the Edwardian era and the interwar era. You know, women couldn't even vote, right? You weren't allowed to show an ankle. Your choices were basically, if you had a career, you would give it up as soon. You only had a career until you got married. Or you lived the life of a so-called spinster at age 30, if you hadn't married yet. Or you entered a nunnery, or you inherited wealth and had some measure of independence. So, you know, at this time, women were still publishing books under male names. So it was difficult to have a any kind of thriving career that wasn't sort of looked down upon. I mean, you could become a whore, or you could, you know, possibly be like a stage actress or something. But for the average, let's say the average housewife looking for something a little bit more, there weren't that many options afforded to you that weren't adjacent to your husband, so, or your father, or, you know, even at the time, you know, male cousins had more rights than women did. So that's kind of important to understand, that the spiritualist movement, really the psychic arts, really helped women sort of put themselves on the map. And what we have today in terms of the psychic arts is because of those women. What we look at today in the paranormal community is on the shoulders of these women who were, you know, considered out there, but also like kind of an acceptable out there to a point. So one of the things that was happening is that women were able to publish as sort of like channeled materials. So in about 1915, Emily Grant Hutchings lived in St. Louis. She was a married housewife, middle-class housewife, had sort of a delightful husband who was head of the parks, and they were sort of described as this bohemian couple. And she was really good friends with a woman named Pearl Curran. Emily got a hold of a Ouija board and brought it to Pearl, and basically the two of them started experimenting with it, and they made contact with an entity called Patience Worth. Pearl began from there on out to channel Patience Worth in through a lot, mostly through automatic writing, but occasionally through the Ouija board, and she found near instant success being published.
Wow.
Yeah. In fact, in 1917, she had a book published called The Sorry Tale. This was a channeled book. It's by Patience Worth, but Pearl Curran was the channeler. And it received accolades. It was given some literary awards, in fact.
And this came from automatic writing, correct?
Yeah, this was a channeled book. This is, through automatic writing.
Now, let me throw one thing into this mix that I want people that are rolling their eyes and, oh, this woman just found her in how to write her own book, but really kind of get the attention. Do you know that there are many, many musicians throughout time and history that will tell you that they sit down and become a channel. Something moves through them. Jimmy Page,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
From Led Zeppelin talks about that openly, that things would just come through him. There are many musicians and scribes that have had that where they feel like when they open that spigot up, the music flows through them. It's not coming necessarily from them, but through them, they're creating. So it sounds weird that somebody's channeling a book or channeling something creative, but artists, musicians, I mean, even going into more recent times, right? You've got the author of the Twilight series who had a dream about a sparkly vampire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Inspired a top-selling book series and movie series. So it's not so far out of the realm of believability.
No, it's really not. I mean, Aleister Crowley channeled the Book of the Law. That was all channeled. That was like one long channeling session. And I mean, it's happened to me if I'm really in the flow. But the thing to remember is these women didn't just channel and then just pop it out there. They actually went through an editing process. You know, they had editors. They went through a publisher. So it was channeled. The divine flow of it was channeled, but then it actually was, you know, polished up a little bit.
Sure.
So there was an element of the writing aspect there. So yeah, I mean, absolutely. Channeling kind of gets this like woo woo type label attached to it. But anyone with a lot of creative ability will attest to that, you know, and sometimes that's just a good thing to do as a creative person, is to just see what comes out and turn off that outer mind and kind of, you know, get into that. So that's kind of what those women were going through. And then Emily went to a session with a famous psychic medium, and an entity made contact asking for a scribe on Earth. And that entity was spelled out the name Samuel Clemens, AKA Mark Twain. And over a series of several sessions, this entity began asking for Emily's presence at the board. And this is how the process began for her to write this book, dictated painstakingly from a psychic typewriter, essentially a Ouija board, one letter at a time.
Mark Twain's Ouija mystery, that is the focus of Shadowzine issue number 3, and you can find that at shadowzine.com. I think you can even find signed copies if you go through Varla Ventura personally and off of her website. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and let's find out a little bit more about Mark Twain and his need to continue his literary masterpiece next. All right, Varla, automatic writing. Now that seems like something that I'd be okay with, allowing the spirits to come through and writing what's coming through the mind right to the hand. That's got to be kind of a fast flow. The idea of sitting down with a Ouija board and one letter at a time writing an entire novel, that's really committed to this entire thing.
It is. Crazy. I think about that. I think about the level of patience and how much time that took, which, I mean, it took them about a year for this novel. But there were a couple of other short stories that came into play.
Isn't it interesting that you use the term patience when, in fact, the first person she began to channel was named Patience?
Oh, right. So that's Pearl. So now we're on to Emily. Right.
I know that, but I'm just saying it's interesting patience. That she was already kind of setting that stage. The spirits were teaching her patience through working on that, right? Yeah.
I know. I have to look up Emily's birthday because I suspect she was a Virgo. That's all. She's got a lot of attention to detail that, you know, I admire, but do not have myself. But one of the ways that this is my favorite part of the story. Mm-hmm. One of the ways that they expedited the process was the spirit. This is how the story goes. The spirit says, the Twain spirit says, you know, something like he's getting tired of spelling out that was a parenthetical statement. And so Emily and her husband get this idea that what they should do is basically put shortcuts for a lot of the, you know, just various and sundry punctuation marks that you would need or other grammatical things. So they painted the Ouija board and they painted an M dash, an N dash, a hyphen, a semicolon, parentheses marks.
Become a typewriter.
So they had some keyboard shortcuts. Yeah. And they describe, and I have the excerpt in the zine. They describe actually getting India ink and sort of like painting these things on. And then the ghost saying something like, can you move that comma down a little lower? I keep falling off the board every time I come running at it. And so there's just all of these fantastic details in the story and Emily's introduction to the book that talk about the process. And, you know, you can fall, like, I want people to make up their own minds. Like, you can fall in camp, Emily absolutely channeled Twain. You can fall in camp, Emily was like eccentric and just looking for a hook. You can fall somewhere in between. I sort of sought to give a little bit of a different perspective, one as a woman and as someone who is aware of the situation that women were in at the time. And two, also, as a writer, I kind of understand where Emily was at. She was actually a very successful writer for the Times and, you know, pretty widely published journalist. So she kind of had a lot to lose by going out on a limb like this. But yeah.
Could you look comparatively at the books and things that she wrote, though, that this was much more in the vein of Mark Twain? Or did it look like this was a marriage of her writing style and Mark Twain?
So everything else she wrote for like women's magazine. She was like a mainstream writer, you know, she wrote like Harper's Bazaar and things like that. So she had a weekly like advice column that was syndicated for a while. And then she would sign her name with things like, I can't remember her. She had like a fake name that she would sign there. And she was kind of known as this like advice kind of gossip columnist. So that is a very different style of writing for sure. The introduction has a very different style of writing than the book itself. Now I will be the first to admit I am not a Twain scholar. I've done my, you know, I've swallowed my share of Twain like many of us have in school. So I'm familiar enough with his life to know that there are elements of him that come through very strongly in this story. Namely, the story is about a kid named Jasper. So that's the title is Jap Heron. So it's Jasper. And he basically goes to this town and he apprentices at a newspaper and he starts becoming the printmaster. And it's kind of a prodigal son story. Twain scholars, I'm sure, would probably say absolutely not. There's no way this is Mark Twain. You know, Emily fans might say, well, you know, it had to come all that way from the spirit world, so it gets a little muddled. It's not a particularly, it's a little painful, honestly, to read the book, the novel itself. And it got some pretty scathing reviews. You know, one of them was like, if this is the best that Twain can do from the other side, we suggest he stays where he is and things like that. Yeah, pretty. And then someone else said, well, if she just had just written it, it would be a great story. But the fact that she tried to say Twain wrote it, you know, they took an exception to that. But the story of the story is really the beauty of this because it goes on into, actually, there's a lawsuit and it goes all the way to the Supreme Court. And there's another great line in the paper where they say, you know, the existence of life after death will be proved today, not by psychics, not by spiritualist mediums, but by lawyers in a court of law. And there was talk that she was going to have to bring the Ouija board in and show her methods. But ultimately, basically, her publisher was sued by Twain's daughter and the Harper and Brothers publisher because Mark Twain is a pen name. And basically, Harper and Brothers were like, well, we own that name. That we made that name. We made Twain. We don't own Samuel Clemens, but we own Twain. So you can use it. Even though she was not the only one to make that claim, I think there's another backstory and a theory that I have as to why they took such exception to her version of this. And that is that there was a man who was kind of the head of the Cyclical Research Society, and he started attending Emily's sessions, and he started taking notes, and then he started writing to Clara Clemens, asking her to verify things that were coming through on these boards. Now, can you imagine, your father's passed away several years ago? You're just trying to get on with your life, right? You're the daughter of the only living child of the greatest, American author of the times, right? And some Yahoo keeps emailing or keeps sending you letters saying, oh, could you verify what your grandfather looked like on his deathbed? And would your father have said this? And so after like the third or fourth letter, she said, you know what? Talk to my lawyers. I can't handle you anymore. Hmm. Well, this guy, so Emily's book gets published, and then this same guy publishes a big piece in his magazine called the Mirror, talking about it. And at this point, Clara's super annoyed, and so are the Harper brothers. And so, in my opinion, this probably would have gone under the radar had it not been for that man harassing the daughter, because it really didn't ultimately hit copyright infringement, in that it really would not have harmed the sales of Twain. Anything, might have pushed them up, but I think there was this interfering element that was not taken into account. So, some dude ruined it for her, basically.
For the full account of this story, get Shadow Zine issue 3. More information at shadowzine.com. Shadow Zine. Plus, you can see all the other great issues that are out and available. Each one can be kept separately, or you can collect them all, which I recommend because each one has great in-depth insights to different aspects of the paranormal world. The very talented and wonderful American author Varla Ventura is our guest as we are talking about Ouija. And I love the work and research you do in bringing a lot of stories that might have been lost to time, which is exactly what Emily Grant Hutchins was doing, right? She was reintroducing Mark Twain in a way that was capturing the attention and imagination of the world. And even though things didn't necessarily go well for her by doing this, it's certainly something that spurred a lot of interest. And maybe people that would go back and buy Twain books to read them, to compare them to Jap Herone, right? And see if there was similarities in the writing styles. So there's kind of that old, you can't make an omelet without breaking an egg thought involved in this.
Too bad you weren't her lawyer, because that would have been a great argument. Hey, this is actually good for Twain's book sales. Just
Your Honor, I say Your Honor, I would like to present the fact.
Yeah, really.
And really, Mark Twain, knowing his personality, knowing his interest in the world and the way that people interact, I think he would have been fascinated by this and interested in that element. I mean, I don't know if professionally it would have bothered him that somebody was kind of bastardizing his name and putting something out there, but the concept behind it, do you think that that would have been something that would have appealed? I mean, that seems to fit into to his writing, right? His books, he had supernatural elements in them.
Yeah, well, they knew each other. That's the other plot twist. They knew each other. There's correspondence between, so Twain came to, so first of all, she was from Hannibal. She was from Hannibal, Missouri. So hometown girl. So of course she was quite familiar with Twain. And then they had met several times and exchanged correspondence. And I have actually read the letters. So one time Twain came to town and delivered a speech. And keep in mind, like this was, you know, it was much later in his career. He had already, you know, published widely, and he was kind of just touring around and giving talks and stuff. And her husband, without being asked, transcribed. So he was a transcriber. Mm-hmm. He transcribed Twain's speech for him. Of course, this is before things were recorded. He transcribed Twain's speech for him and then mailed it to him and said, you know, my wife and I really enjoyed speaking with you. And here's this. And then Twain wrote back very, very politely. And then Emily wrote to him and asked him a few questions about writing and talking about their hometown and things like that. One article I read years ago, which actually made me mad, presented the idea that he had been dismissive of her, and so therefore she did this in like a jilted woman, act of a jilted woman. And I dismissed that theory because, again, like, she had more to lose than she had to gain in many ways. And also, I just think that's like a terrible excuse, you know, to just say, oh, it's just like this crazy woman and she just was out for revenge or she was just trying to get famous. Well, she was trying to get famous. I mean, she had already established herself as a writer. So she wanted that writing career. There's no doubt about that. And we don't know. We really don't know. Was this some sort of fantastic publicity stunt? Because if it was, it almost worked. It kind of backfired in the end. And the fun thing, and I think John at the Salem Talking Board Museum has a copy as well of Jap Heroen. But one of the things with the lawsuit is the books were supposed to all be destroyed. Well, sure they were. That's what Kennerly, her publisher, said. Of course I'll destroy those. And of course he didn't destroy them all. And a few, but very few exist. And he probably did a small print run to begin with. So there's a few copies out there. And then there's a facsimile that has been scanned and is available on Gutenberg. If anybody wants to read the full story of Jap Heroen, read the novel itself. It's probably about a 50, 60,000 word slog. But you can also read the summary in the zine if you'd like. There's so many different elements to the story, and it's just kind of wild. And she really did lose a lot from it. The fact that they're, you know, they were supposedly destroyed. And then I read some funny article about her publisher, who was said to be a rabble rouser. And he published a lot of esoteric and occult things in, you know, early. That's how a lot of the esoteric publishers kind of got started, is in New York. They just published all these like pamphlets and then eventually turned those into books and they became publishing companies from there. So, there's just like so many aspects to it.
Did this cause a wave? Did people start trying to write books via channeling at that time then because of this? Or did it take a bad hit and people stayed away?
Patience Wirth was really responsible for a big resurgence in interest in channeled materials and in the psychic arts during that time. So Pearl Koran's work was more influential. Now, keep in mind, though, she was not claiming that she was writing from, like, the people who've had a little more success with that are the ones that have claimed that they have contacted an entity, but not a named entity, like a ghost, like mm-hmm. the ghost of Twain. But Emily was not the only one to have claimed that she was writing through the ghost of Twain. And I think that there was definitely there was a big resurgence in interest in that. And this played into it. I don't think it turned people off, but I do think it made Emily's family very uncomfortable. And, she was kind of became the black sheep of the family after that.
Why did this story impact you so much that this is something you wanted to share and get out to the world?
I read a little bits of this story years ago. Actually, I was reading it on Gutenberg and thinking, is this really happening? What I think is happening here, because it's convoluted language and it was, you know, written in 1917. So I just really wanted to explore it from beginning to end, but give a little bit of a different perspective, not really land in any one camp, but just give a little bit more perspective on what it was like to be a woman writing in those times. And also being familiar with, you know, the Ouija board and the way the psychic arts work, I felt like as a little bit more in that could give a more well-rounded view of the story.
Well, it's fantastic. And you can get it, shadowzine.com, issue number 3, Mark Twain's Ouija Mystery by Varla Ventura. It is out and available. Plus, you can find all the other great issues that are available for you to read and educate yourself on. So we're left with the question, folks. Was Jap Heroen truly Twain's unfinished business? Or was it a clever con cloaked in a mysticism and seance? One thing's certain, they say energy never dies. But what about the imagination? Can it continue to wonder and create even past the point of life's physical boundaries? Dreams cannot be contained, and in this instance, neither can the stories of a legend. A huge thanks to Varla Ventura for guiding us through this literary haunting. Be sure to check out her books if you love the odd, the eerie, and the deliciously unexplained. Until next time, my darklings, keep your pens ready and your planchettes steady. I'm Dave Schrader, and this has been the Paranormal 360.